Okay, so how many of you were here last time we did designs in DNA? Okay, so that's good. So that background is sort of going to be useful. This time, the topic, you know, I was sort of hesitant about getting into this topic because it can be really, really complicated. And then I started working on it, and I ended up going in a totally different direction. So it's actually going to be much easier than I had first envisioned. However, it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be totally easy. But, you know, the designs in the DNA is actually a very minor component in why we are human versus why we're not chimpanzees. And so we're going to look at some of those other ways that actually affect human uniqueness that aren't actually coded in terms of the gene. Okay, so if you're listening online, you're going to want to get the slides, because the slides are going to help you a lot in terms of knowing what's going on. Because I'm not going to explain everything. There are nice pictures on the slides, and so you'll want to get the slides before you start listening. Okay, and everybody here has a handout, and the handout will also be available online. And the handout is sort of a brief summary of things you need to know, because the last time Mara wanted, you know, how do you use this? And so that's sort of why the little handout is there. Okay, so here we go. Everybody remembers from last time the central dogma, right? Who wants to tell me what the central dogma is? The central dogma of biology. It's central. So everybody should know this. Okay, so it's basically DNA that encodes the genes and everything that happens within a cell. It gets transcribed into RNA. And the RNA is the message. And so all of the transcription happens within the nucleus, but all the action happens outside the nucleus. So the transcribed RNA goes out of the cytoplasm, and it gets translated into proteins. And proteins, are, of course, the workhorse of the cell. But there are other things that are happening besides just this. And actually, this is probably not the most important thing that's happening. Or at least the way it's controlled is probably more important. So if you look at genes, like the total number of genes, you'll find that the number of genes in a worm are about the same as the number of genes in a human being. So the question is, you know, can 300 additional genes turn this into this? So here we have a 1,000-cell roundworm, and next to it we have a 40-trillion-cell human being who has different organs and everything. So we only have a 300-gene difference. But obviously, between a roundworm and a human, some of those genes are a little bit different because, you know, different things need to happen. But let's look at an example where the genes really aren't that different. Okay, so you know that the human genome has been fully sequenced, the chimpanzee genome has been fully sequenced, and the protein coding genes are 98.7% identical. So there's only a 1.3% difference in the protein coding genes. So, you know, can
the whole overall genome?
That's the protein coding genes. Just the protein coding genes. Okay. So can a 1.3% difference turn this into this?
I hope not.
I don't think so. Okay. So I'm gonna make that case, and first we're gonna look at some butterflies. Now, how many people think that these two butterflies are related to each other? Just a show of hands. Anybody think that these are related? Okay. How many people think that these two butterflies are the same species?
They are.
These are identical species. One of them develops in the summertime. The other one develops in winter. And it turns out that this species is actually in Kenya, which is very near the equator. So the difference is actually due to temperature, even though the temperature at the equator between summer and winter is not that dramatically different. Okay, so this is a totally temperature-dependent difference in terms of development. So we know these two butterflies are genetically identical. Right? They're genetically identical. They don't look the same. There must be a reason for that. What about these? Here we have three butterflies. How many people think this is the same species? It is. This is our second example. Okay. Now let's go into a different species. Okay, everybody knows what this is. This is a nice little alligator, and it's got some young near it. Now, how many people think that the difference between a male and a female alligator is due to some chromosomal difference?
Yeah, would think so.
You would think so, right? But actually it turns out that it's a temperature thing. Okay, if the temperature is less than 86 degrees Fahrenheit, all of the eggs will develop into females. Every single one of them. Okay, if the temperature is above 93, then all of the eggs will develop into males. Okay, so you can guess that for the most part, probably about 80% of the eggs are going to develop into females. And when it gets really hot, you know, you get a few males just to procreate the species.
Between 83 and 93?
86 and 93.
Are they hermaphrodites?
No, you get one or the other, but you get mixtures of populations.
Oh, mixtures.
Yeah. Okay. So here we have, you know, all the alligators are genetically identical, but some of them have male sex organs and some of them have female sex organs, and it's totally due to temperature. How does that happen?
Temperature.
Yeah. If you took the larvae of both of those first butterflies that we looked at, and you switched them into different temperatures, would they be the other color, like the blue one?
Yes. Yes. They've actually done those experiments in the lab,
okay,
where they've taken the caterpillars, they've raised them, and when they pupate, then you know, depending on the temperature they're raised in, they'll come out different colors.
Oh.
Yeah. Is that cute or what? It sounds like you could market that for something. Okay, the conclusion of all this is that the genotype is not everything. Okay, so we have two different terms here. One is genotype, and the other one is phenotype. Now, genotype, of course, is the genetic sequence. So it's actually the sequence of base pairs. The phenotype is some observed characteristic. And the observed characteristics are dependent not only upon the genotype, but it's also dependent upon the amount of the gene products that are expressed. Okay, so the control of how those genes are expressed is probably really, really important, as we saw in the previous five or six slides. And that's what we're going to look at today. So the U.S. government started this study, a long-term study. It's called ENCODE, the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, and it was launched in September of 2003, and it was designed to identify all the functional elements in the human genome. Okay, the results were published in 2012, and it involved 1,600 experiments, 147 different cell types, and it was authored by 450 investigators from 30 institutions. So this is a big project that was really well coordinated. And the results were 15 terabytes of data, not all of which we're going to present today. And the results are, and it came out, it was really surprising to people. The results are that about three-quarters of the genome is actually transcribed. So in other words, the DNA from three-quarters of all the sequences is turned into RNA. Okay, but the percentage of the genome that actually codes for proteins is only 2%. So what's all that RNA doing? It's not coding for proteins, it's doing something else.
Is that 2% part of that 74.7?
Yes, it is part of it. So we can lower it down to, you know, 72.7 for the non-coding parts. So 56% More than half of the genome is associated with modified histones. And we're going to go into this in some detail a little bit later. But histones actually control gene expression. And it's the way the gene, the DNA is wrapped around proteins. And 15% of the genome is in open chromatin areas. And these are areas that are extremely highly transcribed. Another 8.5% binds transcription factors. And the transcription factors are small proteins that bind to specific sequences on the DNA, and they alter gene expression. Usually they cause genes to be expressed more. And 4.6% of the genome consists of methylated CpG dinucleotides. Okay, and these are two sequence bases that are sort of interspersed throughout the genome. And when they're methylated, they turn off gene expression. Okay, and they're put in significant places where they can modify the expression of genes. So ultimately, ENCODE found that 80% of the genome was actually functional. Even though those numbers ended up more than 80%, but that's because a lot of them are overlapping. Okay, so what do the scientists say about their data? Ewan Burney says, there's not a single place in the genome that doesn't have something that you might think could be controlling something else. And that's sort of a very awkward way of saying that everything is doing something.
Or doing something.
It could be. And Michael Pazin says, very little of our genomes is junk. Now, as you can imagine, not everybody was happy with this. And there was this evolutionist named Dan Grar who wrote an article that was called On the Immortality of Television Sets, which actually didn't have anything to do with that. But essentially, his point was, he said, only sequences that can be shown under selection can claim with any degree of confidence to be functional. Okay, so he didn't like the ENCODE results because only things that are under selection should actually be functional according to his ideas, which of course is based upon evolution. So the question is, what's wrong with that perspective?
Aren't there a lot more purposes to a life form than just selection?
Not according to evolution. Everything has evolved from something else, so everything must be selectable. Right? In theory, that's what evolution says. Everything has to be under selection.
There's a too high standard of evidence. How are you going to show that it's under selection?
Okay. That's an excellent question. That was my next question. So how do you know that something's under selection?
Can you define under selection?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I'm going to do. Does anybody know what that means?
Natural selection.
Natural selection. How do we know that things are under natural selection?
Something's working on that gene to change it, either from external.
But how do you measure that?
It could be either deleted, modified, or added.
Right, okay. So you look for sequence similarities among different species, related species. Okay, that's how you determine under selection. Okay. You compare the genome sequences of different species, and they should be similar.
Or you can see changes, modifications, or
right.
Rich, are they saying that some sequences are not selectable, that they're not...
We're getting to that.
Okay.
We're almost there. Okay, so his other complaint is that ENCODE uses an evolution-free definition of functionality. Okay, so this is the main problem here. And actually the subtitle of his article is Function in the Human Genome According to the Evolution-Free Gospel of ENCODE. Okay, is that pretty interesting? Pretty interesting.
What's ENCODE?
Okay,
you think this was produced by a church.
So the question is, what percentage of the genome is actually under selection? Anybody have a guess?
All of
80%. 80%
No, 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 it's not 80%. He wouldn't have written this article as 80%. It's 10%.
No.
Okay, so 80% is actually doing something, but only 10% is under selection. That's why he's not happy. Okay, so we're actually going to get into this a little bit more in detail a little later. But now we're going to go through each category. And so the main category is transcription. Okay, so transcription is, you know, the DNA being converted into some kind of RNA. And we know that only 2% of the DNA actually codes for proteins. So there's the other 73% that is doing something else. And we're going to find out what that something else is. So people who came last time will remember this slide. Okay, this is a look at alternate splicing of RNA. And essentially, genes consist of multiple exons and introns. Almost all the genes have more than one exon. And, you know, it seems like a really weird thing because, you know, all the gene is transcribed and then the exons or the introns are sliced out. So here we have this gene is transcribed up on the top, and then it produces the exons, which are the final message. Okay, and in this case, we have five exons. But the RNA can be spliced in multiple ways. So instead of maybe getting five exons, we could also get just four exons. So now you have a final message which has two alternate forms. And so by this way, you can make multiple isoforms of a protein that have totally different function. Okay, so last time I showed that, you know, scientists had expected like 100,000 different genes because they had that many proteins. But this is why there aren't 100,000 genes. There are only 20,000 genes because you have multiple ways of splicing the RNA to get different gene products.
I thought it was 30,000.
No, it keeps going down.
It keeps going down, right?
Yes, right now it's just above 20,000. Yeah. Okay. So now we're gonna compare some alternate splicing between different species, but first we have to understand a technique. And the technique is called principal components analysis. And it's a statistical feature in which data is transformed. So whenever you do any kind of genetic analysis, you'll have essentially thousands to tens of thousands of data points. And, you know, to plot all those tens of thousands of data points on a graph is going to look a little bit busy, and it's going to be sort of messy. So what we do is we use principal component analysis, and what it does is it converts all those data points into one point. So each of these points on this graph are actually composed of, in this case, it's data from some of my research, 17,000 transcripts. It's all converted into an XYZ coordinate system. Okay, and the way this works is that 75% of the variance, in other words, 75% of the difference in different samples in this data set are on the X-axis. Okay, so those are the distance on the X-axis is the most variability among the samples. So your closest samples will have about the same value on the X-axis. Okay, now on the y-axis, we have about 23%. Okay, so it's much less. And on the z-axis, it's only about 2%. So in a lot of these analyses, they just sort of don't even do a z-axis. So this data in particular, let me go through exactly what this data is showing you. So here we have, this is IBD data research. Okay, so this is from our group at Cedars-Sinai. And group number one, the orange squares up in the upper right corner are normal individuals. Okay, so they plot in this principal components analysis in the upper right hand corner. Now below that is an IBD group, and this IBD group is actually plotting around the same level on the x-axis. See, so they're sort of aligned vertically. Okay, so these individuals are much closer to normals than the other two groups, the green and the pink group. So the green and the pink group are two different groups of IBD patients, and those patients have more severe disease than the other groups.
Please remind me, what is IBD?
Inflammatory bowel disease.
Oh.
Okay. Inflammatory bowel disease. So this is just an example of a principal components analysis, and you can take the graph and you can rotate it in multiple dimensions, And you can see where the points are lining up. So now let's go on to our basic study. So what the scientists did is they're looking at alternate transcripts in different ape species. Okay, so they're comparing those to humans. And one of the things they did was they're looking at the brain. Okay, so here we have principal component one. Remember, that's about the 75%. And principal components 2 is about 25% of the variance among the samples. So here are different species. And the interesting thing about this graph is that the humans are not anywhere near any of the apes. Okay? So we see that we have, in this case, we have much different alternate transcript PCA analysis in humans versus the apes, in this case for the brain. Okay, they've done it for several other organs, and they've also done it for the cerebellum. Now, the cerebellum is a part of the brain that controls mostly motor function. So, you know, when you think of terms of humans versus apes, in terms of motor function, we're going to be more or less similar because the kind of motor things we do are, you know, somewhat similar. So here you can see that the groups are sort of squished together more. Okay, which is what you would expect for something where you don't expect big differences in terms of functionality. Okay, they've also done this for the heart. And, you know, and for the heart, things are even more squished together because the heart just pumps blood, and an ape heart and a human heart probably do about the same thing. Okay, and here's the liver, and they're all together except for the rhesus up there, and I don't know why. Why he's up there, but he is. Yeah, he is a monkey, but you would think his liver would work the same. I mean, they're eating similar stuff.
Richard, are you looking at genes or proteins?
Okay, here we're looking at alternate transcripts. Okay, so that was our main topic here. We're looking at alternate transcripts and how those differ among different species. So in terms of, you know, the final conclusion of this is that the alternate transcripts are different between humans and apes. Okay, and it's mostly in the brain, which is probably what you would expect since there are large functional differences between human and ape brains.
By transcripts, again, you mean almost 75%, which is transcribable?
Yes.
For the RNA?
The RNA. Okay, so the next thing we're going to look at is we're going to look at the expression of genes. Okay, so we know that 98.7% of the genes are identical, okay, between chimpanzees and humans. But the question is, are they transcribed the same? Do we get the same levels of each of these genes, or are they different? Who wants to bet on it? they're probably different. Okay, so we're going to do a Venn diagram here, and we're looking at human versus chimpanzee. So what you can see is that about 10% of the genes are over-transcribed in humans, and about 10% of the genes are over-transcribed in chimpanzees. So the net result is that about 20% of all the genes are transcribed differently between humans and chimpanzees. Okay, only 2% of the sequence is different, but 20% of the expression is different. Okay, so that's where human uniqueness comes in. Okay, they've also done this for bonobos, which is another species of chimpanzee, and the results are about the same. It's about 20%. And then, of course, they compared chimpanzees and bonobos, and there's virtually no difference. Okay, so there's obviously something going on here with the expression of genes that is different in humans than in chimpanzees. And it could have something to do with why we're different. Ow.
I was reading something about genes that says that, you know, we're not made. This guy was using we're kind of like baked. And if you bake the genes too long, you'll get a jaw, and like in the apes and chimpanzees that are longer, and the head smaller, and the humans, you do the opposite, you get a larger head and smaller jaw.
Okay, so that's probably why we have this differential expression. So it's actually the expression of the genes. It's not the genes themselves. It's the expression that makes humans unique. Yes?
Do these expressions of DNA and RNA multiply together? Do they add together? Is there some relationship like that? Does one leverage the other?
Okay. Well, right. This one is only looking at expression. Okay. So there are different ways of looking at all these patterns, and they probably do interact. And we're going to see that a little later as we go through some of the different functions of some of these RNAs.
Richard, I think Al was talking about developmental precursors.
Yes, that's
yeah,
exactly it.
Not expression.
Okay. And this is actually done in iPSCs. So these are induced pluripotent stem cells, which are a proxy for embryonic stem cells. So this is actually what's happened. This is what would happen in embryos during development in terms of gene expression differences. Okay, so now we're going to go...
By expression, you mean turning on versus off.
Right, on versus off.
Yeah, developmental is not that. That's
no, development is on and off.
No, it can be just environmental pressures that cause an organ to...
Environmental pressures can cause genes to go on and off.
It can, but also it can just make like a bone more dense or more robust without changing the gene expression.
Probably not.
Yeah.
My guess is that the gene expression is... You need to have some way of getting to phenotype, and it's got to be either through coding or it's got to be through expression. There aren't a lot of other choices there, I don't think.
Okay. Let's finish my question. That, to put it in very simple terms, let's say there's 10 genes in this hypothetical, and that's the whole genome of an ape and a human. Let's say the human has 10 genes and the ape has 9. So they're 90% identical in this hypothetical example. What you're saying here, however, is that in the case of a chimpanzee, gene numbers, you know, maybe 1, 3, 4, and 5 are turned off, but in the humans they're turned off.
Yes, actually. So you know, we only have a 2% difference in the actual genes, but we have like a 20% difference in the expression of those genes. So that's where the action is. The action is not in the gene itself; it's in the expression of the gene. And we're going to go through some examples of how this gene expression is actually controlled. And one of the ways is through microRNAs. Now, who thinks they know what a microRNA is? It's going to be a very small RNA. Okay, so that you know, this is not rocket science. You know, this is just okay. And it turns out that these microRNAs are only about 22 base pairs long. Okay, now how does that compare to like a gene? A gene can be hundreds to thousands of base pairs. So these are really, really small things, but they have a big impact on gene expression. And it turns out that microRNAs control about half of your genes. Okay? So they're considerably important. Okay, so we're going to look at how microRNAs are actually made. And like all RNA, microRNAs are encoded in the nucleus. And there's a protein called exportin 5 that exports the microRNA out into the cytoplasm. Okay, at this point, the microRNAs is joined by what are called argonaut proteins. And these are proteins that bind to it, and they sort of help it in terms of its structure and function. And next we have this other protein that's called dicer. And dicer slices off the hairpin curve of the RNA. Okay, so now we have a double-stranded RNA here, and it's attached to some proteins. And it turns out that one of the strands is not used at all. So one of the strands is discarded. And this is the final functional RNA. So it's a single-stranded RNA, a small RNA with about 22 base pairs attached to this protein. Now, what does it do? It actually has a sequence that lines up with some kind of message. Okay, so here's your gene, The gene has a sequence of bases on it, and sitting over there in the corner is the ribosome, which is getting ready to translate this gene into a protein. Okay, so the microRNA can bind to it, and when it binds to it, there's a problem. Okay, the ribosome can't go anywhere. Okay, so what this does, the microRNA turns off expression of the gene by preventing its translation. Now, the other thing it does is cells don't like double-stranded RNA. They're like not permitted, sort of. And so it makes this RNA, this message RNA, it makes it somewhat unstable. And so it'll also result in its degradation. Okay, so those are the two ways that microRNAs control expression. And they tend almost always to down-regulate expression of genes. Okay, so the question is, are these microRNAs, are they ubiquitous throughout all the vertebrates and all the mammals and stuff, or are they more or less specific? And so if you look at the data, what you'll find is that 29% of the microRNAs are only found in humanoid forms, okay? Not found in any of the other species. 29% of all the human microRNAs. Yes. Another 26% is present in monkeys. Okay, so these are shared between humans and monkeys. And less than a third are actually found in other mammalian species. Now, you know, in research we tend to use mice and rats and stuff, but you know, if you're doing microRNA research, that probably isn't going to work too well, because there aren't that many that are actually shared. And then in non-mammals, it's only 16%. So it's really, really small. So this is basically a design that's primarily aimed at individual species. Okay, so microRNAs are a means of making humans unique from other species. Okay, our next set are called long non-coding RNAs. And these were actually not discovered very long ago. You know, it was assumed originally because of the evolutionary paradigm that all of this stuff was junk and it wasn't doing anything. But there's actually these long sequences, and these sequences are at least 200 base pairs long. So they're much bigger than the microRNAs. And they have some interesting regulatory functions. So here we have our mRNA again, and it's attached to a ribosome, and here we have our long non-coding RNA. So like the microRNA, it can bind to a message and it can block translation of the message into protein. Okay. The other thing long non-coding RNAs do is that they can bind to specific proteins. And when they do this, they regulate transport or coactivation signals. So they're sort of a coactivator of other protein function. And a third thing that they can do is some of them can actually bind microRNAs. So here you have your microRNA, and it can bind to the sequence on this long non-coding RNA. So by this function, you can actually prevent a microRNA from doing its inhibitory function. So we have long non-coding RNAs that inhibit. We have some of them that actually enhance by blocking the microRNAs. So you can see that the systems are redundant, and they're also integrated together, which makes it look like it's almost designed. Okay, another function that the long non-coding RNAs have is that they will bind to transcription factors. And transcription factors, of course, are the factors that enhance DNA transcription. So a long non-coding RNA can cause a gene be transcribed more than it normally might. And the final function that we have is that the long non-coding RNA can bind to a message, and it can cause the message to be either alternately spliced, as we saw before, or it can cause the message to be degraded. Okay, so there's like five or six functions that these long non-coding RNAs have. And they're really becoming a force in terms of regulation of gene function from current studies.
How in the world do these long coding RNAs know which of the five functions they're supposed to do? Or does that get too complicated?
You don't want to go there, no.
Yeah, we'd like to get to the end of the show.
Right, we would like to get to the end of the show.
I would like to get your conclusion.
Okay. Okay, so we saw how these long non-coding RNAs function. Now we're going to look at some of the ways that they actually function in terms of different species. Okay, so this is a series of graphs, and I don't want you to get scared by the graphs. But there are lots of little lines and stuff that we're going to go over. But this is basically, it's a density graph. So essentially, the number of long non-coding RNAs would be plotted on the y-axis, and the x-axis is the length. Okay. So generally, longer non-coding RNAs are going to have more functional than short ones. Okay. So what we have is the orange lines are long non-coding RNAs that are not associated with ribosomes. So essentially, you would expect these long non-coding RNAs not to have as much function as the ones that do associate with ribosomes. Because if it's associated with a ribosome, that means it's doing something to protein translation. Okay, so if we look at the orange lines, we can see that, you know, in the higher species, we have the orange lines. In the lower species, you know, flies and yeast and plants, we also have those transcripts that are not associated with ribosomes. But if we look at the blue line, the blue lines are the ones that are associated with the ribosomes, and you can see that there are many more in the higher species than in the lower species. In the lower species, there's virtually nothing. So this is actually a means of regulating gene expression in higher animals. That's its primary purpose. And this is a graph of, or this is a chart of different kinds of RNAs and how similar they are, how they're matched among species. So if we look at the first column is mRNA. Okay, that's the message RNA. And of course, we're 99% chimpanzee. We already know that. And 98% rhesus, 97% cow. You didn't know you were 97% cow. 96% mouse. And some people are more than 93% rat. But we don't have those people in this class. Okay, but the interesting thing is that is not what we see in terms of the long non-coding RNAs. Okay, there's a fair amount of similarity in the simian group, the apes and chimpanzees and stuff, but in terms of like cows and mice and rats, our long non-coding RNAs are vastly different. They don't match up. Al?
Doesn't the mRNA
they're so close. That's the coding RNA.
Does
yes.
That, does that point to a common ancestor?
Yeah, it points to similar design.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, but in terms of common ancestor, you're gonna need something that's selectable, Al.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not selectable in these long non-coding RNAs. That's a problem.
Natural selection.
No, that's a problem. It didn't work. It didn't work. It only worked in this column. Did not work in column two. That's the whole point.
Sorry about that.
Well, the problem is that's what you believe does not match column two. Okay.
Relics.
We're not eight.
Okay. So so actually, in terms of long non-coding RNAs, the similarity is actually similar to a random sequence. So they are really, really different. That's sort of the control group there. Now we have another creature. This is called a heat map. And it looks like lots of colors and sort of liney things and everything. And it's a way of expressing lots and lots of data on one little compressed item. So we're looking at, on the top, we're looking at different organs. So we have brain, skeletal muscle, heart, liver, spleen, etc. And for each of these organs, we also have different species. So we have rhesus, cow, mouse, rat, going in the columns, going up and down. Okay, so we're going to zoom into this. And what you can see now is you can see that you have little bands going across. And it turns out that each band actually represents one long non-coding RNA. And so as you go across, you'll see the comparisons of the different species and the different organs for each of these long non-coding RNAs. And the way this map actually works is the light-colored ones, the white ones, those are not differentially expressed. Okay? Those are identical. So it's the red ones that you want to look at. The red ones are the ones that are different. So we're going to zoom out here. Back to our picture. So what do we see here? What do we notice? Where are the vast differences?
Brain.
Brain. Okay, you got it. Okay, good.
And
go. Okay. Well, those are the important things. Okay. So here we have the long non-coding RNAs are vastly different in human versus ape versus other species. Okay, so that goes along with that previous table that we had that showed that there were vast differences, and this is the heat map shows where they are. And we also have in the testes, which we're not going to talk about today. Probably not. Okay, we're going to move on to our next class. And this pseudogenes, this used to be the evolutionist's favorite topic. They would always say, look at all these genes, they got duplicated, and they're junk, and they're not doing anything. Wrong. Okay, so the question is, you know, originally they said these were just evolutionary relics of randomly duplicated genes. Okay, there are two different ways, from a naturalistic perspective, that these pseudogenes get produced. Okay, one of them is simply gene duplication. So you get a gene that's accidentally copied twice during the copying process, and that copy gets incorporated into the DNA. But then after the copy gets incorporated, some kind of mutation happens in the copy, and the copy no longer functions. So it probably doesn't produce RNA, but it could, and it definitely doesn't produce protein. So that's the one theory on how pseudogenes are formed. The second one is called a process pseudogene. And in this scenario, what happens is the gene actually gets transcribed. So the gene goes from DNA into RNA. Then the RNA gets processed, the introns get sliced out, and you end up with your final message. Now, at this point, something really interesting happens. And it's a result of something called a retrovirus. Anybody know what a retrovirus is?
RNA virus.
RNA virus, that's it. Yes, okay. So a retrovirus is actually a virus that instead of having DNA inside of it, it has RNA. Okay, so when it infects your cells, it shoots some RNA into your cell, and how is that going to get multiplied? You know, the cell doesn't have any way of making RNA into RNA. There's no system of doing that.
It's
so
reverse transcriptase.
Reverse transcriptase, yes.
It makes DNA.
So what it does is it has this protein called reverse transcriptase. So it will take this RNA that's part of its genome, and it will turn that into DNA. And once you have DNA in the cell, then the cell knows what to do with that. It takes the DNA and it makes RNA. But instead of making message, it's making RNA virus. Okay, so that's how you get, that's how these retroviruses work. Now, so you have this cell that has this processed message, and instead of actually reverse transcribing the viral DNA, the reverse transcriptase actually reverse transcribes the message. Okay, so you end up with this piece of DNA that has, you know, it'll usually have, like, you know, the untranslated regions, and it'll have the exons, but it won't necessarily have the introns, and it won't have a promoter. So this little piece will get incorporated into the DNA, and it won't work because there's no promoter and there's no mechanism of getting it actually transcribed. So those are the two evolutionary theories. Now, the other possibility is that pseudogenes are actually designed to mimic the gene whose expression they control. Okay, so we're going to look at some of that data and see how that works.
Is that like an endogenous retrovirus? Is that like an endogenous...
Well,
is it called endogenous retrovirus?
Endogenous retrovirus, in theory, is a virus that has been incorporated into the genome. Mm-hmm. Okay, the virus itself has gone into the genome, as opposed to, you know, a pseudogene is actually something that theoretically arose from a human gene, as opposed to some viral component. Okay, so we're going to look at how pseudogenes actually function, because until about 5 years ago, nobody believed that they had function, but they do. So this is called the phosphatase antensin homolog gene, P10 for short, and it codes for a phosphatase protein, and the phosphatase protein actually regulates cell division. Okay, so the presence of the protein will slow down cell division and prevent them from dividing too rapidly. Now, what happens if cells divide too rapidly? What do we call that?
Cancer.
Cancer. Okay. So when you have mutations of this gene, guess what happens?
Cancer.
You get cancer. Okay. So mutations in this gene are bad. But the gene is actually controlled, and it's controlled in a couple ways. Okay. First of all, here we have our friendly microRNA. Okay. So what's going to happen when this microRNA binds to this P10 message? What's going to happen?
It'll shut it down.
Yes, excellent. Okay, so here we go. We bind. Okay, we don't make the protein. So what's that going to do to the cell?
Rapidly multiply.
It's going to cause it to rapidly multiply. Okay, sometimes you want cells to multiply, right? There are times when you want that to happen. And you want to be able to turn that off also. Okay, so here's the way we do that. Okay, we have this pseudogene. It's a piece of junk. No, it's not really. Okay, so this is P10 pseudogene 1, and it makes a message that's similar to the P10 message, except, you know, it only has part of the message. It doesn't have the entire message, and it doesn't code for any protein. It just makes this message. Now, the interesting thing about the message is that it also binds this mRNA. Okay, so when that happens, what happens? Okay, the controlling factor here has been removed. The microRNA has been removed. You're going to get the protein. Okay, so here you have this feedback loop where you have, you know, the pseudogene is producing a message which controls the microRNA, which controls the amount of protein you get. Is that cool?
It could go to either one.
But if you produce this one in excess, then this protein is going to be produced. So everything is controlled. That's the great thing about these systems. The systems have multiple levels of control. And here we're controlling the level of translation based upon this transcribed pseudogene.
That's when it fails and we get cancer, right?
Yep, that's what happens.
Is this currently in use?
Is this in use?
I mean, can we...
You mean, is there a medical application for this?
I know there is, but I mean, do we actually have...
I don't think there's any way to do this, because... you know, you would need some kind of gene therapy, which was a really good idea, but it never really panned out. So, yeah, I don't know if
it's incredibly complex.
If that'll ever happen. Yeah, there's just too many problems. Okay, so actually, the first pseudogene that was discovered was actually discovered in mice that had a function, because they found that if they knocked out, they were randomly knocking out parts of a gene and nearby locations, and they accidentally knocked out a pseudogene of one of these mouse genes, and then it was a lethal mutation. So there are actually pseudogenes that are required for development, and we don't know what those are necessarily because it hasn't really been studied very much so far. So we had the one example of pseudogenes. So let's go on to something interesting. Let's go into histone modification. Okay, so this comprises over 50% of the function of genes. And you'll remember last time we have this picture of a nucleus. We have heterochromatin, which is not transcribed, and we have this euchromatin, which is transcribed. And it turns out that this histone is part of the way the gene is organized. So here we have our DNA, which is wrapped around these four histone proteins, and it's all attached by histone H1, which is in yellow. And these nucleosomes are organized sort of in this flower pattern with the histone H1 in the middle. And the histones, these little flowers are sort of organized together to produce these long ropes, which are coiled, and then they're coiled again, and then they're supercoiled. Okay? So all this DNA is really highly compressed and very highly organized in terms of the chromosome.
Richard?
Yeah.
This stuff is so tiny, right? How do they get in there to it's all a kind of a slimy mess, seems to me. How do they get in there to unravel and to see what's going on in these genes? It's amazing.
Well, they can
do it to me.
So, you know, all of this stuff is studied. Okay, so... No, this is a lot of it's done through different kinds of studies that aren't necessarily related to visual, because you know once you get to that size you don't have things that actually can image these, although they do have some electron micrographs of the nucleosome. But
questions or comments about Rich Penn's
team? Okay, so the interesting part about this is how much DNA we actually have and how long that is. So 3.2 billion base pairs in a cell, okay, in a set of DNA, and each cell is diploid. So that means that there are two copies, which means there are 6.4 billion base pairs. Each base pair is 3 times 10 to the minus 10 meters long, which means that each cell contains 2.2 meters of DNA, which is about 7 feet. So that's a fairly long amount of DNA. So it probably needs to be organized. So if you look at the average human has 37 trillion cells. So if you take and multiply that, the total length of DNA inside of you is 8 times 10 to the 13 meters. Now, what does that mean? How far does that actually go? So the distance to Pluto is about 3 times 10 to the 9 miles. So we're going to convert that into meters, and it ends up being about 6 times 10 to the 12 meters, which means that there's enough DNA in you to go from here to Pluto and back over 6 times. Okay? That's a really long length of DNA, so it needs to be organized. Otherwise, it would be sort of messy. Okay, so... the organization is actually based upon the histones. They have little tails on them, and the tails are actually important. They're there for a function, and the function is that they have different sites on them that control gene expression. So you have sites that are acetylated, and acetylation of histone proteins turns on gene expression. Methylation turns off gene expression. You have phosphorylation, which tells the cell that DNA has been damaged and so that the repair mechanism can go in and fix it. And you also have ubiquitination, which controls the methylation of certain ones of these histones. and then some of these components that actually interact with each other. Okay, so this has been called the histone code, and it basically affects over half the genome. So this is how the expression is controlled. Okay, so here's why evolution by natural selection is false. 80% of the genome shows function. 10% of the genome is evolutionary conserved, which means that 70% of genome function is not explained by evolution. Right? Okay, is that a problem? I think it's a problem. Okay, therefore, most of the genome is designed. Okay, did everybody get this?
Rich, what do you mean by evolutionarily conserved?
Okay, that means that there are similar sequences in other species. Okay, so if you're an evolutionist, what are you going to do about this? This article came out less than a month ago in the journal Nature, and it says, does evolution need a rethink? And essentially, there are people in evolutionary biology who want to change the principle of evolution from its current natural selection and genes into something else. And the something else is called the extended evolutionary synthesis.
That's a schmiff.
Okay, so here we have the standard evolutionary theory, and the standard evolutionary theory has actually become a theory of genes. Okay, so the idea was that you have these genes, the genes undergo random genetic mutations, the mutations get selected by natural selection, and you end up with gene fixation within a population. So this is sort of standard evolutionary theory. But obviously there's a problem in terms of how this goes out into the genome and explains all the function that you have that is not under selection. Right? There's a problem because this didn't happen for most of the genome. Okay? So this must be missing something. And it probably is. Okay, so their new theory, the extended evolutionary synthesis, is actually a theory of forms. And so what it says is that you have environmental influences, you have developmental plasticity, in other words, during development, certain things can happen differently depending upon different kinds of influences, and you have certain developmental biases that happen depending on those influences. And this results in phenotypic change in the absence of genetic change. Now that's sort of weird, isn't it? Okay. And then after this, then you get these phenotypic changes actually hard coded into the genetics. Okay. So this is the new theory, and right now almost nobody accepts this. But there are obviously problems in terms of natural selection and getting all this function that you can't get with in the absence of natural selection. Okay. Now, the problem with this theory, anybody know what the problem with this theory is?
There's no mechanism.
There's no mechanism. It's like, okay, we went down from point A to point B. How do we get from here to there? There is no mechanism. It's sort of like punctuated equilibrium. Well, it explains what we have, but how did we get there? We don't know. Right.
If they get it to work by factory, we'd like it.
So that's sort of the shortened version, and we missed the transcription factors and the CPG sites, but I think it was okay.
But that'll all be available.
Yes. It'll all be on the website, but it won't have any audio with it.
Thank you.
How about another presentation some other time?
To do the other part?
And the same conclusion, you know, just maybe half a second.
Okay, so, yes.
20%. Is that possible? Like, that would be found to have function of some sort? It's just the current state of technology that limits us to 80?
Okay, so let me tell you how the studies were done. All the ENCODE studies were done on cell lines. Okay, the great thing about cell lines is you can just grow them in your flask, and you don't have to go anywhere. You just, you know, you grow them in your incubator. You take them out. You do some studies with them, and they're perpetual lines, so they grow really easily, and you can do them easily. But what application does that have to real cells? See, in my research, you know, we get blood samples from patients. We isolate the primary cells, and then we look at that. Okay, they have not looked at any primary cells. They don't actually know what's happening in terms of what's really happening in your body as opposed to these cell lines, which are supposed to be proxies for the real cells. So there is a possibility that the cell lines do not define the entirety of human genome function. So I'll leave that out there, but we don't know, basically.
Richard, who's doing the research?
Those 450 guys.
30 different institutions.
Well, the 450 guys, those are the guys who are in charge of the lab. Mm-hmm. Each lab probably has, you know, 20 guys who are working for this guy. So there are, you know, thousands of people working on this. Yes.
Is the process of sequencing DNA gotten faster then? Is that one of the ways?
Okay. The process of sequencing DNA has gotten faster, and it's gotten cheaper. Okay. So the major problem, you know, we at Cedars, I have a bank of samples, about 1,000 samples. I don't have the $1 million to run those samples on what I want to do. So I have to pick and choose stuff. So, you know, one of the main problems with research is we don't have the money to do all these really fancy things that are really easy to do, but they cost money.
I have a question. Do apes and other animals have developmental disabilities? Some do?
I would guess so, but the issue is that for most other animals, if they have a developmental disability, they become food. So those kinds of genes are not passed on. Now, human beings, you know, we will actually take care of people who have these problems, and they won't become food. So our genes tend to be sort of not selected out.
DNA would be a large pool. I talked about a survey that came out that a lot of the animals in Australia, the marsupials, are going extinct because their population is so small, their gene pool is so small that the mutations are driving them to extinction in real time. We're able to witness these extinctions now where they just don't have the genetic diversity to survive.
Yep.
So, Richard, has any of this been done on Neanderthal tissue? Or is there enough available, like the RNA studies?
There are no RNA studies because there is no RNA. RNA is really unstable.
Yeah.
So it doesn't last very long. Even in the lab, we have to put it in the freezer and everything. So. Father in heaven, we thank you for your wonderful designs, and we thank you for all the ways that you've made us unique, especially instilling in us your spirit so that we can follow you. And we thank you for all your blessings that you've given to us in terms of physical creation and spiritual creation. In Jesus' name, amen.